apartment, followed by one of those elegant barefoot weddings on the beach, and she'll be pregnant with her own Lily baby just in time for her 40th birthday. Have you two met Ian? Asks Sophie, all tasteful conviviality. She pats Ian's arm possessively to make it very clear in an entirely subtle way that they are an item. Aunt Connie's solicitor. Yeah. Hi, Ian. We've met. How are you? Thomas pumps Ian's hand, looking at him meaningfully as if to say, I've been taken hostage by these two women. Save me. Do you practice divorce law by any chance, Ian? Deborah gives a tinkling laugh. I'm just wondering, that's all. No particular reason except that last night my husband and I were... I think it's time we found ourselves a good strong cup of coffee. Thomas takes a firm hold of her elbow. Come on, Deborah. Oh, well done. You remembered your wife's name. Did you have to really concentrate? But she allows herself to be led away, with Thomas pushing the stroller and Lily beaming and waving a chubby hand. Bye-bye! Bye-bye! As though she's as desperate to get away as her father. Ian watches them go and shakes his head. Oh, it brings back so many happy memories of married life. Sophie chuckles lightly in a way that indicates it will obviously be very different when they're married and says, How have you been since I saw you last? Ian turns to her. His eyes are shining with a frightening new evangelical zeal. Well, actually, a lot's changed since I saw you last. Religion? Acupuncture? Hatha yoga? The Atkins diet? Whatever it is, she can sense the approach of a nasty sandstorm about to blast through her beach wedding. And it's all thanks to something you said when we went out the other night, when you were talking about seizing the day. Sophie stares at him. I have never in my life used the words seize the day. Okay, well, maybe not those words, but you certainly talked about the principle of it. Anyway, it's all thanks to you. I'm giving up law, and I'm moving to New Zealand to be a whitewater rafting instructor. Grace and Aunt Rose are packing up their face painting equipment. They both agree that they must have surely painted the face of every child on the island, and that it gets more tiring every year. And next year, they really should get some help. Aunt Rose is going off now to sit in the tent with Grandma Enigma, and Grace is going to get them both something to eat. Grace helps Aunt Rose to her feet and feels the delicate, bird-like bones in her arm. Oh, I'm an old fogey, darling, aren't I? Rose winces and clutches at her back. I look in the mirror sometimes, and I think, who is that old woman? I never thought I'd be this old. Connie and I used to laugh at the thought of us as little old ladies, and we'd pretend to hobble around on our walking sticks. And now, look, I actually have one, and it's not just for show. I need it. Grace just smiles. I'll see you at Grandma Enigma's tent. Just a cup of tea? Yes. And maybe a piece of angel cake. It won't be as good as Connie's, but at least they're following her recipe. Rose walks off through the crowd. From behind, in her long black coat, with her hair hidden by her hat, she doesn't really look that old at all. She might need the walking stick, but she hasn't lost the gliding ballerina walk that Grace remembers from her youth. Grace pulls the note Margie left for her from her jeans pocket. Darling, I've double-checked re the anniversary menu and just wanted to remind you that you're fine to eat everything on the menu except for the satay sticks. Well, that's a pretty obvious one. Those tiny parmesan biscuits, lethal sesame seeds, and the samosas. Walnuts, if you can believe it. Have fun. I hope Grandma Enigma manages the baby okay while you're doing the face painting. Don't tire yourself out. Love from your Aunt Margie. Kiss, kiss. P.S. I know this is so annoying of me, but I can't help it. I just wanted to suggest that perhaps Jake could wear that little red hat I gave you. It will keep his little ears lovely and warm. I know. I'm sorry. Deborah nearly snapped my head off when I suggested Lily wear her one. So snap my head off, if you like. But I know you won't. Can't wait to tell you all about my Weight Watchers party, which I've been so secretive about. It will give you all a good laugh, that's for sure. She doesn't want Margie to blame herself. But she won't, surely she won't. And everybody will say to her, "Oh, Margie, she had the note from you right there in her pocket. It was perfectly clear. She must have been distracted and forgot. It was just a tragic accident." But will Callum say, "Yes, but she never forgets"? It's true that Grace never eats a piece of food cooked by anyone else without double-checking, without saying, "I'm sorry, but could you please double-check with the chef?" Sometimes even after everybody has confirmed she's safe, she'll put a morsel to her nose between pinched fingers and sniff like a suspicious dog and feel a tingle of danger at the back of her throat. A vision of a quick stir with a spoon covered in quivering golden drops of deadly sesame oil, and she'll drop it back onto her plate and say, "I don't trust it." And Callum will have to be restrained from marching into the kitchen to grab the chef by the throat and demand explanations. "My wife's life is depending on you," he sometimes says to waitresses. So melodramatic and sweet. And he gets so mad when Grace forgets to take her EpiPen out with her. And if they're going out to dinner, he makes her pull it out of her handbag and show it to him before they leave the house. But nobody will be surprised that she didn't bring it to the anniversary night. And Callum will be upset at first, but it will just be the shock, really. And he'll know deep in his heart that he and the baby are going to be better off with Sophie. Sophie will talk about music with him and go dancing with him and swing her hips and jiggle her shoulders and move like a woman, not a cardboard cutout. Sophie will make friends with that huge circle of Callum's friends. She'll go to those loud, happy, tipsy barbecues without feeling sick flutters in her stomach. And she won't just find a chair and sit there with her arms and legs not quite right, just sitting there for the whole night, holding her drink too tightly, worrying that everybody thinks she's a cold, snobby bitch, and secretly thinking the steak marinade has too much salt in it. Oh, no. Sophie will be flitting from circle to circle, laughing and chatting and making everybody chuckle. She'll know all their names and all their kids' names. She'll have long, chatty conversations on the phone with Callum's lovely mum and say, "Oh, hi, Doris." She'll love Jake like a proper mother and do tuck shop duty and throw birthday parties and jump up and down on the soccer field. She'll blush and giggle, and Jake will grow a foot taller than her and put his arm around her and say to his mates, "This is my mum." His darling little mum. And nobody will think all that much about Grace, except to say, "Oh, what a terrible tragedy." Jake is with Grandma Enigma right now, wearing his red woolen hat. He's warm and clean and fed, and there are 11 lasagnas in the freezer and dozens of bottles of expressed milk, and all the washing is up to date, and Sophie is just over there, the pretty pink good fairy waiting to step in. And Grace did the best she could, but it wasn't enough. She never felt it. She never felt a thing. And it will be such a glorious relief, such a release. Like when the pain reliever begins its soft, fuzzy drift through your bloodstream, like cool grass on your bare feet after white-hot sand, like sleep closing down your brain after a long, exhausting day. She looks around her, and all she can see are children with Melly the music box dancer and goblet faces. her own smiling creations mocking her for thinking she could be happy. And it seems to her that the children are the only ones who can truly see her despicable core. And she can see their eyes shining at her through their painted faces, and they're all saying, "Yep, do it, Grace. Do it. It's time." Bye, everybody. So long. Au revoir. Gublet McDublet waved to all his friends from the window of his spaceship, but nobody even lifted their head. Melly the music box dancer hadn't been to see him all night. They were all too busy playing. Ron runs towards the wharf. He's going to take his jet ski over, which means his clothes are going to be drenched. And if the cabbie at Glass Bay complains about him dripping river water all over his cab, he's either going to put him in a headlock and threaten to kill him, or else he's going to give him all the money in his wallet and say, "Look, mate, just take me to the Hilton. My wife is there with some hairy-chested gold medallion-wearing guy named Ron, which is my name. I know, I can't fucking believe it either." He'll tell him he'll pay him double the value of any speeding tickets. Triple. "Do you want to come and watch?" Was he for real? Had Margie got caught up in some weird, trendy cult where they all practice fetishes? Even the word fetish makes him shudder. Ron does not like fetishes. He has no fetishes. He likes normal, straightforward Australian sex with a woman. And the woman should be his wife, and the woman shouldn't sleep with anyone else but him, and afterwards they should have a bit of a cuddle and fall asleep in their own bed. Simple! Bloody hell! Why did he take such simple good things in his life for granted? As he gets to the water, he sees a familiar figure in the moonlight walking towards him. "What are you doing here?" he calls out in surprise. But he doesn't stop running long enough to find out. Sophie has decided everybody on the island has had quite enough fairy floss and packed up her machine. All the children seem to be on sugar highs. Their colourful, painted faces make them look like miniature demons, and the older ones are running around in feral packs, making strange roaring sounds. Shouldn't they be in bed? Callum's jazz band has packed up their instruments, and loudspeakers are pounding out Latin American music. The street performers have all stopped performing. Sophie can see two clowns kissing passionately. There seem to be quite a lot of people trying out dirty dancing for the first time in their lives. Sophie takes off her wings and puts a denim jacket over her dress. She had intended to find something to eat, but uncharacteristically, she's lost her appetite. All she feels like is more mulled wine. She's drinking it like water. The more she drinks, the better it tastes. There is a gentle buzzing sound in her head. It is so funny that both the eligible men in her life have been eliminated within half an hour of each other. Oh, it's just hilarious. The girls are going to fall about laughing. Her life should be a sitcom, it's so funny. She giggles, but it sounds like a hiccup or a sob. The thing is, as well as being funny, it is also humiliating. Because she thought she was so great, so attractive, having two men interested in her, when she wasn't even especially interested in either of them. All of a sudden, she thought she had all the time in the world. Pride comes before someone trips you flat on your face. And now here she is, single and nearly 40. So very, very single, and so very, very nearly 40. That elusive marriage and babies thing has slipped through her clumsy, grasping fingertips. She just couldn't get it right in time. There won't be a Lily baby or a Jake baby for her. She's going to be on her deathbed and thinking about her achievements as a human resources director. That will be her gift to humanity. The morale committee will gather around gratefully. The only person who is apparently in love with her is Thomas, who is married to somebody else. And the only person she's in love with is Callum, who is also married to somebody else. Sophie. Ha! I was just thinking about you. Sophie looks up at Callum and feels herself pulled irresistibly to him, like metal shavings to a magnet. She has to dig her heels into the ground so she doesn't suddenly superglue herself to his chest. Really? What were you thinking? I was thinking... Gosh. She has absolutely no idea how to finish the sentence. Callum doesn't seem to care. He seems bright-eyed and fidgety. Were you thinking you'd like to dance with me? How funny, that's exactly what I was thinking. Callum holds out his hand, and Sophie takes it. A manic happiness floods her bloodstream. He leans towards her with wide eyes and says, "Don't you think the mulled wine is amazing?" "Oh," says Sophie fervently, "I think it's delicious." Rose is walking towards Enigma's tent, worrying about Grace, although she's not sure exactly why. Something about the expression on her face just then. It was so disinterested. It was wiped clean. It reminded her of someone's face from her past. Actually, she knows who it was. It reminded her of that Jenkins boy when they saw him at Dora's wedding after the war. Oh, but for heaven's sake, that's ridiculous. Grace isn't suffering from shell shock. Grace isn't about to do anything silly. The Jenkins boy had hung himself in the family garage. It's probably just that Rose has always been slightly worried about Grace, ever since the day Laura brought her home from the hospital and handed her over to Simon, saying, "Here, you stop her crying. You're the one who wanted a baby so bad." Oh, but Grace is fine. She's got Callum, who anyone can see adores her, and the baby is thriving. The music is too loud. Her back hurts. Someone knocks against her. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry," and then disappears into the crowd. There seems to be a frenetic, out-of-control feeling to this year's anniversary. Everybody she sees is carrying a glass of mulled wine. It seems very popular, even though Rose had a taste, and it definitely has too much lemon, not enough nutmeg. As she finally reaches the baby Munro tent, she can see Enigma sitting up in her chair, pointing her finger at someone, as though she's Lady Muck. What sort of person would Enigma have been if she'd just been a plain old Beth or Agnes? Veronica and her new friend are there too. The friend is holding Jake. It seems that everyone is talking at once to a man wearing, oh dear, a yellow t-shirt. It's the kook. He's obviously found Veronica. As Rose gets closer, she sees him hold up the strange urn and announce, "These are the ashes of Alice Munro. My mother, Alice Munro." Veronica's mouth drops and stays dropped. Enigma guffaws. "Well, I don't know whose ashes they are, but I can assure you they're not the ashes of Alice Munro." "Oh, for heaven's sake," says a familiar voice next to Rose. Rose turns. "What are you doing here?" Ron roars across the river on his jet ski. He's going to take her on a campervan holiday in Tasmania. He's going to finally hang up that god-awful baby in a flower pot print in the sunroom. He's going to be more patient with her mother. He's going to let her watch whatever that rubbish show is she wants to watch on Sunday nights. He's going to go on picnics. He's going to put Christmas lights on the guttering. He's going to ask her, "Do you still miss your dad? Because I miss him." And, "Do you still write to the parents of the missing children in the paper, which you thought I never knew about? And do you still know the words to all of Buddy Holly's songs? And Do you think our children are normal? And Jesus Christ, was Veronica trying to tell him she was a lesbian tonight? I thought you were in Turkey, says Rose.
I decided to come home early, says Laura.
Laura, says the cook uncertainly, lowering the urn.
What can I get you?
Just one of those samosas, says Grace.
They look nice.
You're pretty good, says Callum.
I know I am, says Sophie.
The music thuds inside her. They're on their own invisible island, surrounded by gyrating people. They're moving like one person. He's gonna kiss her very soon.
Your mother was Alice Munro? Veronica is ecstatic. It seems that nothing in her world is as fixed and boring as she thought.
So what happened to her? Why did she leave? What happened to Jack? This is amazing. Incredible.
She looked at Audrey, who is gorgeous and calm and jiggling the baby expertly over one shoulder.
Can you believe this, Audrey?
Enigma says, he's a con man, I tell you.
Oh, am I?
The kook shakes the urn. How can you prove these aren't the ashes of Alice Munro?
Laura snorts with derision.
Oh, David, give it up.
Do you actually know this man, Laura? Says Enigma. I suppose you met him in some dreadful foreign country. Why are you back so early, anyway? Nobody told me you were coming back early. Have you noticed that Margie isn't even here tonight? I'm here all alone, dealing with problems like this.
I'm back early because I decided I want to spend time with my grandson.
Laura looks at Jake in Audrey's arms and pats him tentatively on the head as if he's an exotic animal.
Is that so strange?
Where is Grace?
This child looks hungry.
And who are you? Are you the babysitter?
Don't tell me they've got a nanny. How terribly trendy of them.
Veronica is in a frenzy.
Audrey is my girlfriend, Auntie Laura. I became a lesbian while you were away, but I'll introduce her properly in a minute. This is important. How do we know for sure this man isn't telling the truth?
Oh, he's just trying to get money out of us, says Laura disgustedly.
I dated him for a while. I met him at Parents Without Partners. I made the mistake of sharing some confidential information with him after a few too many Chardonnays one night.
Veronica, did you just say what I think you said?
Oh, Laura, that's disgraceful, says Enigma.
But why didn't you ever bring him home for dinner?
Exactly what confidential information did you share with him, Auntie Laura?
Veronica's face is pink, her hands clenched.
You'll just have to wait till you're 40 to find out, says Enigma.
Till I'm 40?
Rose looks around helplessly for a chair. There are shooting pains up the back of her legs. She looks at the self-satisfaction on Enigma's face and the anguish on Veronica's. Oh, it's all so silly. It's so tiring. 73 years of lies. 73 years of thinking before you spoke. 73 years of fear, like walking along a cliff face. How tempting to just step out into thin air.
Be quiet, Rose, orders Connie in her head. I'm sorry, Connie. I've just had enough.
Enough is enough. She reaches for Veronica's hand.
We know he's not telling the truth, darling, because Alice and Jack Munro never existed.
Connie and I made them up.
You made them up? You never found a baby? There was no baby?
Or what?
Why?
Well then, who is Grandma Enigma?
Rose has a glorious sensation of freefall.
Well, she's my daughter, darling.
Enigma throws her hands in the air and wails.
Oh, now look what you've gone and done.
Callum's hand is warm on the back of her neck, and he's pulling her to him. And some sober, tomorrow part of her mind is saying, "Calm down, Sophie. It's only a tacky, drunken kiss. It's not a tidal wave. It's not an earthquake. It's not a miracle." But some other part of her mind is thinking, what a beautiful and appropriate word swoon is. And how she's swooning like a Regency romance heroine who's never been kissed in her life, except that now, oh God, oh fuck, oh thank you, his tongue is in her mouth. And has every other kiss in her life been leading up to this ultimate perfect kiss? Yes, she thinks it has.
Eating the samosa is like eating a piece of evil. Grace is committed to going ahead, but she hadn't realized just how difficult it would be to go up against the habits of a lifetime. She has to physically force the hand holding the samosa up to her mouth, as though the air around her has turned into wet concrete. For a few seconds, her mouth stays jammed shut, while her nostrils contract in horror.
Nuts, nuts, we smell nuts.
But finally she manages to unclamp her lips and shovel a corner into her mouth. She is standing away from the crowds on the main street, leaning with her back against a tree. The crowd is a heaving, solid mass, faces glowing under the lights of the giant heaters. Callum and Sophie must be in there somewhere. Dancing, probably. Making life look so simple. She waits. And there it is. The first warning of every allergic attack of her life. A shuddery shiver straight down her back. Icy fingertips caressing her spine. She swallows convulsively and waits. There is the unbearable sandpaper scratch in her throat. It's moving faster than any other reaction she can remember. She's being strangled from the inside. Her eyes fill with water. She claws at the bark of the tree. The pain is her punishment for not loving her baby. But now it's impossible to hold on to that thought because she can't breathe. What a complete fool! What an idiotic thing to do! Every thought in her head is wiped clean except for the need to breathe. Ah, oh, for God's sake! She can't breathe!
Rose is exhilarated. She wants to dance. Her backache has vanished. It's all over, she says to Enigma. I told Connie years ago we should just tell everybody the truth. I feel so good. I feel all light and airy. Enigma is crying, of course, snuffling into her hanky.
Well, I certainly don't feel light and airy. Oh, why isn't Margie here? Laura, make Rose stop talking. Do something. It's all your dreadful friend's fault.
The kook has put his urn on the floor and has folded his arms aggressively across his chest.
People are going to want to sue you.
It's fraud. You women have committed fraud.
Well, you should know all about fraud, says Laura, because that's what you are here to commit, weren't you? You thought because you knew the truth you could get away with this pathetic stunt. Got some more gambling debts to pay off, have you?
Oh, dear. Enigma is momentarily diverted from her crying.
I don't think you should date a gambler, dear. They're awful people, gamblers.
For God's sake, Mum, I'm not seeing him, says Laura. Rose notices for the first time that Laura is looking better than she has in years. She has a lovely gold tan, and her forehead looks all smoothed out. She's wearing a wonderful necklace with an oval red stone. Laura, she says, that necklace is really beautiful.
Don't we have a few more important things to talk about here than Auntie Laura's necklace? Asks Veronica. And that's when somebody yells into the tent with frantic authority, "Is there a doctor here? There's a girl having some sort of allergic reaction." Grace? Is it Grace?
Enigma lifts her tear-stained face. Veronica has already sprinted from the tent like a runner hearing a starting gun.
What's going on?
Veronica's new friend jiggles the baby up and down in her arms.
Who is it? Where did I put my bag?
Laura kicks violently at the ground around her.
Somebody find my bag!
The kook picks up a black leather bag from the ground and she snatches it from him and runs off behind Veronica. And Rose's legs shake so badly that Enigma and the kook have to grab at her elbows to stop her from falling.
What's going on?
Some woman is having some sort of fit. I think it's an allergic reaction. At the moment the words penetrate Sophie's molten consciousness, Callum shoves her away from him, and it's like being wrenched awake from a beautiful dream by a shrieking alarm clock. Grace's limbs flail in raw, uncontrollable panic. She clutches at her throat and makes guttural sounds. There is a blur of strange, frightened faces around her. And then there is a face leaning close to her, and a swinging red pendant on a chain, and a voice saying, "Hold on, Grace." And every molecule of her body is drawn to that familiar, cranky voice. Because, of course, she won't let her die. Of course she won't. Chapter 50. The phone has been ringing at intervals for hours, it seems, but Sophie just lies in bed with her pillow held so firmly over her face that she is practically suffocating herself. She takes it away and pulls a face at the ceiling. She stretches out her mouth into an elongated oval. She scrunches her face into wrinkles and bares her teeth. She makes strange yah, yah sounds, pretending she is insane and wishing she was. She puts the pillow back over her face. She has a headache, of course. She knew she would have a headache, but actually it's not even that bad, just a blurry ache behind her eyes. It's a strange sort of hangover. Her mouth doesn't feel horrible. It feels quite nice and nutmeg-ish. It would be better if she had an all-consuming, run-of-the-mill hangover that would make her forget the shameful, shriveling feeling of Callum pushing her away. The revulsion on his face. As if he'd swallowed a fly. As if she was a desperate old tart trying to stick her tongue down his throat. And then, it was like a nightmare. Seeing Grace's beautiful face contorting spastically, spit at the corners of her mouth, her eyes rolling into the back of her head like a frightened horse. "Shit, I think she's actually dying," somebody said in an awe-filled voice. Callum was on his hands and knees next to her, his fingers digging into the dirt, and Grace's mother took a plastic tube from her handbag with yellow and black writing, pulled off the lid, and without pausing for even a second, took a firm hold of Grace's leg, lifted her arm high in the air, and plunged it down, stabbing her hard, murderously, really, and the crowd gasped collectively, but quietly, as if they were in church. Grace's body arched in the middle and then slammed against the ground, and Sophie caught sight of Veronica also on her hands and knees, bursting into tears. And Sophie had never seen Veronica cry before. And there was Thomas shouting into a mobile phone the words, "Anaphylactic shock," his face all red. and Sophie had never heard Thomas raise his voice before. And it was all so awful. So truly awful. 20 minutes later, a police rescue boat came roaring up the river, but by then everyone knew that it looked like the woman who had the allergic reaction was going to be fine. She was breathing normally, thanks to her quick-thinking mother. And really, you'd think people with dangerous allergies would be a bit more careful about what they ate. The anniversary night was suddenly over, and people were trooping down towards the wharf to line up for the ferry, with sleeping, face-painted children draped over their shoulders. Callum and Laura went off in the boat with Grace to the hospital. Veronica recovered her normal, frenetic equilibrium and was going on and on about how she didn't understand how Grace would have eaten a samosa when Mum had written her a note, and why in the world would you put walnuts in a samosa? They needed to have a good talk to the caterers. And had Sophie heard that the Alice and Jack story was a complete hoax? They never even existed. Aunt Rose had got pregnant with Grandma Enigma when she was 16, and Connie had come up with this elaborate lie. It was such a betrayal, really. And who was going to look after Jake tonight? She hadn't brought Audrey along to provide free babysitting. And apparently Auntie Laura had seen Dad going off somewhere on his jet ski, fully dressed and looking quite demented. And you'd think Mum would be home from her Weight Watchers party by now, and if Auntie Laura hadn't been carrying around the EpiPen in her bag, Grace would be dead by now. No doubt about it. Dead. "Is she always like this?" Audrey had asked Sophie. "Should I slap her across the face?" Sophie had wondered vaguely if she should offer to mind Jake for the night, but it didn't seem appropriate. What if Callum came home and was horrified to find her touching his child and shoved her away again? Besides which, she was drunk, and she thought child-minding was probably like driving, something you shouldn't do when you're over the limit. Luckily, it soon became irrelevant because there was a family squabble over who should take Jake for the night. Aunt Rose said she'd do it, and Grandma Enigma said, "Don't be ridiculous, you've got the Alzheimer's. You can't take care of a baby." Thomas said he and Debbie were all set up for Lily, and they would take Jake home with them. Although Debbie wasn't such a good advertisement for motherhood herself, as she was sitting on the ground next to Lily's stroller with her head in her hands, shaking her head sadly over her empty glass of mulled wine, while Lily reached over from her stroller and stroked her mother's hair. Veronica said no, Jake had obviously taken a liking to Audrey, and she and Audrey would take him back to Callum and Grace's house and stay the night there. And in the end, nobody had the energy to argue with her, and it did seem that Jake looked very comfortable with Audrey, and she seemed very competent and calm. So everybody went home to bed. Sophie had walked back to Aunt Connie's house in a daze. She'd managed to take off only one shoe before hopping into bed in her fairy dress, and obviously she'd had intentions of cleaning her teeth, because when she woke up she was still holding her toothbrush with a carefully applied line of toothpaste. She has no memory of doing that at all. The phone rings again. It's probably her mother, feeling guilty about last night. This time, it only rings a few times before it stops abruptly, as if the caller has slammed down the phone. Sophie continues pressing the pillow down into her face and tries to think of something extremely boring and non-emotional. Tax returns. She sets herself a mental test to see if she can remember her tax file number. It is a stupid test. She can't remember one digit of her tax file number. All she can remember is how it felt to dance with Callum, and how her lips had tingled with anticipation as he lowered his head, and actually her bottom lip is still tingling quite painfully now. She takes away the pillow and gingerly puts a finger to her lips. For God's sake, that's why her lips were tingling all night. Because she was getting a cold sore. She hasn't had a cold sore since she was 16. She gets out of bed and hobbles to the bathroom, still wearing one shoe, and looks at herself in the mirror. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the ugliest woman of them all? There is an extraordinary strawberry-shaped blotch right in the center of her lip. She's been branded for kissing another woman's husband. Her hair is a comical bird's nest. There are half moons of mascara under her eyes. She is a hungover, herpes-ridden old witch. She's so ugly, it's funny. And what's really funny is this. She does love him. It's not a silly crush. She's actually fallen in love with him. And she is never going to be with him. She doesn't even want Grace to leave him. She just wants to be living in the parallel world where he never met Grace at all, and instead he met Sophie at the Pseudo Echo concert back in the 80s, and they dated and got married and had 3 kids, and now she pretty much takes him for granted and sits on his lap like he's an old armchair. And they're trying to find ways to spice up their sex life. And on Saturdays, they ferry their kids around to soccer and netball, and on Sundays, they work in the garden. She wants that life so bad. You stuffed up big time, Buttercup. The doorbell rings. Sophie doesn't even bother to smooth down her hair. She is irretrievably unattractive. She kicks off her shoe and walks down the stairs in her crumpled up, pink fairy dress, fingering her cold sore with enjoyable disgust, muttering to herself like a mad old crone. She flings open the door.
Good morning, darling.
It's Rose, and she's cut off all her hair. It's a white elfin cap, and it makes her neck look longer and her eyes larger. She's wrapped in a stunning, richly beaded pashmina.
You look a bit tired.
Sophie says, Well, you look beautiful. I've dressed up to celebrate the end of the Munro baby mystery. Rose lifts a corner of the pashmina.
This is a gift from Laura. It's from Nepal, or somewhere like that.
As Rose turns her head to examine the fabric, Sophie feels a shock of recognition. She says, I can't believe I've never noticed before how much you look like Grace. Rose smiles sadly.
Well, she is my great-granddaughter, even though she doesn't know it yet. Imagine that.
If she died last night from her allergic reaction, she would never have known I was her great-grandma.
I think that's terrible. I really do. I could wring Connie's neck.
What have you done to your lip, Sophie? Sophie holds the door open and lets Rose walk in front of her. She answers, It's a cold sore.
Oh, says Rose, I think you're meant to put lemon juice on it.
Who told me that?
I know. It was Rick, the gardener. I think he gets them sometimes.
Sophie makes a silent, gruesome face at herself in Connie's hallway mirror as she passes it. Have you heard how Grace is this morning? She asks.
Yes, apparently she's fine. Just shaken up. What a scare she gave us. We could have lost her. Thank goodness for Laura. Do you know what Thomas has done today? He's gone out and bought one of those EpiPens for each of us, so we can all carry one. And they cost an absolute fortune. One for you as well. But you know Tom, he's a terrible worrier. He'll be worrying over this for years after we've all forgotten it. Oh, and did I mention Ron ended up in jail last night?
No.
Yes, it's all a bit confusing. Margie had to go and get him, and apparently she wasn't at a Weight Watchers party at all. Enigma wasn't making much sense because she's very cross with me and thinks I've got Alzheimer's. She won't stop crying. What a night it was. What with the kook, and Laura coming home, and Grace, and... Well, goodness me. Anyway, why don't you go and have a shower while I make us a cup of tea? Would you like me to scramble you a few eggs? Oh, no, no, sit down, please. Sophie flaps her hands ineffectually, but Rose is too much at home in Connie's kitchen. She's already taking out a glass bowl and tut-tutting as she discovers the eggs in the fridge. You must keep your eggs at room temperature. I thought I'd mentioned that before. Quickly, go and have your shower. You'll feel better. Then we'll put some lemon on that cold sore and you can eat your eggs while I tell you the whole story about Alice and Jack. We're going to put out something called a media release, you see, and I want everyone in the family to hear it all first before we go public. So Sophie stands under the shower and lets the water spray hard on her face and thinks about how Rose meant her too when she said, everyone in the family. As she towels herself dry, the smell of scrambled eggs and coffee is drifting up the stairs, and she wonders if there is something profoundly superficial about a person who can take so much pleasure in the thought of eating breakfast, even when her heart is split right in two. Chapter 51. It only takes about half an hour for the Munro baby mystery to be unraveled into a simple, straightforward, sad story. Sophie listens while she eats her breakfast, and her cold sore throbs, and sunshine floods Connie's kitchen, so that Rose's eyes look especially blue and young as she talks. Connie always started the story with my turquoise crepe de chine. She'd say, Rose went dotty over some dress fabric. But I'm going to start a bit earlier, because I'm in charge now. It was 1932, the year Farlap died. You know Farlap? The racehorse? Sorry, darling, of course you do. Oh, you saw the movie. I don't seem to like going to the pictures anymore. I can't get comfortable. Yes, I suppose I could take a cushion. Well, anyway, I mustn't digress. Veronica was nearly having a coronary this morning when I wouldn't stick to the point. Her new friend was chuckling away. She's nice, isn't she? She seems to be a very special friend. Well, anyway, it was the year Farlap died. I can remember Dad hearing it on the wireless and stomping about, saying that Farlap had been poisoned by American gangsters. We didn't take much notice. There were only two weatherboard houses on Scribbly Gum Island then. One was the house where Connie and I lived with Mum and Dad, and right on the other side of the island was our grandparents' house. You could only get there by boat then, because we hadn't cleared away any of the bush. Grandpop lived there on his own. Grandma died when I was only very little, and I don't remember much about her, except that she always knelt down when we visited, so she was the same height as me. And I liked that because it was like she suddenly became a child-sized grown-up. I wish I could kneel down for Lily and Jake, but it hurts my knees too much. Grandpop was Harry Doughty, who had won the island in the famous Ashes bet when he was a young man. He was very proud of winning that bet. It was like his lifetime's achievement. We had to hear the story quite a lot. Well, Connie and I adored Grandpop and Mum, but to be quite honest, we weren't that fussed on Dad. He fought in France in the war, and as Mum always said, it hadn't been a walk in the park. Poor man. He had a bad shoulder because of a shrapnel wound and problems with his right eye because of the mustard gas. He was also, how can I put this nicely, a little soft in the head. I guess these days they'd have him seeing psychiatrists and all that. Mum said he'd been a happy-go-lucky fellow before he went. He joined up because he thought it would be a lark. And it wasn't a lark at all. He hated it.
He saw his three best mates die right in front of him, and he thought somebody should take the blame for that. He wouldn't stand up when they played God Save the Queen. He'd ramble on, and he didn't make much sense, really. Mum said he came back different, but that was the only way we knew him, so we didn't really believe her. It was like living with a large, unpredictable dog. Well, Connie and I had such carefree, tomboyish lives. Idyllic, really. Such freedom. Sometimes I feel sorry for the children today with their sports and their ballet and their violin lessons. Connie and I could go wherever we wanted in our rowboat. Of course, we did have to go to school each day in Glass Bay, but that was all right. Connie was a star pupil. There was a lot of talk about her going off to the university. I was just average, I'm afraid. Too dreamy. After school, Connie and I would just spend hours mucking around on the island and exploring the river, fishing, swimming. We had a special shady spot down on the beach at Sultana Rocks, and I'd sketch girls wearing beautiful dresses while Connie read her mystery books. We didn't go home until it was dark and we were hungry. Actually, I think we were quite spoiled, really. I didn't think until I was much older how hard our mum must have worked and how tired she must have been. Dad couldn't get any work, you see. He was a butcher before the war, but he couldn't find a job when he came back, which was just as well, Mum said, because she was sure he'd chop off his fingers with his bad eye. He was fighting the repatriation for years to get a pension. I can still see him at the kitchen table, angrily dictating letters to Mum because he couldn't see well enough to write. Mum had to work to support us. She had a job at a clothing factory in the city, and she'd come home and Dad would be there leaning on the fence waiting to have his tea cooked for him. It never occurred to him that he could have helped around the house. Never occurred to us, either. It's just the way it was. But Mum never complained. She always had such funny stories to tell us about her day. Connie and I would be in stitches. She was always losing things. She was hopeless. She would lose her train ticket and have to sweet-talk her way out of it with the guard. Well, she was so pretty, with all that curly blonde hair. That probably helped. Once she accidentally posted her pay packet with some letters, and she had to wait for hours until the postman came to empty the postbox. Ah, she was a character. She was a wonderful cook, better than all of us, even Connie, and such a talented seamstress too. She made all our clothes without patterns. For Christmas each year, I would draw a sketch of the dress I wanted, and she'd make it for me. Well, one night in August, Mum left her only warm jacket on the train and came home chilled to the bone. Her teeth were chattering so hard it was making her giggle. She was making brrr noises with her teeth. Connie was cross with her. She said, "You'll get sick, Mum." And sure enough, she did. There wasn't enough money for another coat for her, and Mum did feel the cold. It started out as just a sniffle, and then it turned into a serious, chesty cough. She'd lean forward with her hands on her knees and cough and cough and cough. Well, she needed a dose of antibiotics. By the time Connie and I took her off to the hospital in Glass Bay, it was already too late. She died of pneumonia a few days after. She was 37. Whenever I get a prescription from the doctor for antibiotics, I look at the pack and I think, that's all Mum needed. I think this ordinary box of pills would have saved her life. I remember Connie and me standing there at the hospital, looking at each other, not touching, not crying, just completely and utterly shocked. Our mother was too busy to die. The only time I can remember seeing her lie down was in the hospital. Is that the phone again, Sophie, love? Do you want to get it? It's okay. Sophie gives a dismissive wave of her hand. This is more important. Rose smiles at her, takes a sip of tea, clears her throat, and continues. It was just 1 month later that Grandpop died too. I think it was the shock of losing Mum. He loved her. I think he was probably in love with her, actually. Well, all of a sudden everything was different. Nothing looked familiar anymore. I can remember walking out the front door and looking at the river as if I'd never seen it before. Everything was menacing and grey. My whole world looked and smelled different. There was only Connie, Dad, and me on the island, and it felt so empty. It needed more people to fill it up. It seemed like Mum had created enough energy and jokes and stories for 10 people. It was an awful time, Sophie. We were all grieving, and we didn't really know how to do it, so we just flailed hopelessly about. It was so cold, too. I remember that. Connie and I couldn't get warm. Dad went all religious in an angry sort of way. We'd always been Catholics, of course, but now Dad was reading the Bible out loud every night and wanting Connie and me to kneel down and say the rosary with him. He went on and on about how Mum hadn't been to confession before she died, and Connie yelled at him, "What would she confess? That she lost her good coat? Was that a mortal sin?" Dad slammed the Bible down on Connie's knuckles, and she just laughed. This horrible, bitter laugh. We soon found out that we were in terrible financial straits. Connie had to forget about doing her leaving certificate and try to get a job. She walked around the city for weeks and weeks, lining up in endless queues and coming home with puffy blisters on her heels. I don't think I'd even heard the word mortgage before. We didn't know we had a mortgage or that Dad's wireless was on a time payment plan. We didn't know it was going to take us years to pay off what we owed the grocer. We had no idea Mum was only barely keeping us afloat. She protected us from all that. So Connie became obsessed with money. All she could talk about was ways to make money. You know Banksia Island, of course, just north of us? Well, during the 30s, Banksia Island was a very popular picnic destination. It had quite a successful tea house, and the scones there were dreadful. So heavy and lumpy. Connie kept saying, if people tasted our scones, they'd never go back. But nobody had even heard of Scribbly Gum Island in those days, and why would people come to us when they could go to Banksia Island? We had to give them a reason, and of course we did eventually, and the poor old Banksia Island tea rooms went out of business quick smart. Although those scones were really unforgivably bad, so we didn't feel that guilty. Dad said Connie should stop jabbering about scones and just get tenants into Grandpop's empty house. He seemed to think it would be so easy. I can remember him shouting at Connie, "Just go along into Glass Bay and organize for someone to let the house. We'll charge them 15 shillings a week. That's more than fair." He was quite oblivious to the fact there were empty houses all over Sydney because no one could afford to pay their rent. There were evictions every day. I can remember walking through the city and seeing people sitting outside their homes, surrounded by all their possessions, lamps, cushions, saucepans. But you see, Dad never left Scribbly Gum. He barely left the house. He was in his own dream world. Well, one day Connie got sick of Dad haranguing her and told him that she'd found tenants for Grandpop's house, and their names were Alice and Jack Munro. She said the Munros were good Catholic people and they were paying 5 shillings a week. And here was their first rent money. I remember Dad saying, "We're not a bloody charity. They must think it's bloody Christmas." But he seemed to accept it. And seeing as he never took the boat around to Grandpop's house, he wasn't ever likely to notice that Alice and Jack were never home. Connie would chat on and on about this mythical Alice and Jack Munro. She seemed to get a kick out of conning Dad. The rent money really came from Connie's new enterprise as a bookie. The railway workers would come down and meet her at the wharf and place their bets with her, which she'd record in a book with a red cover. It was illegal. She was breaking the law, you know. I was frightened for her, but she loved it. Of course, she didn't make nearly enough money. We weren't starving, not like children in Africa. But, you know, there were some days when we went to bed quite hungry. I can tell you, we never took food for granted again. One day, a friend at school said that her sister could help me get a job at a big department store in the city, working behind the cosmetics counter. So, of course, I had to leave school and take it. We needed the money too badly. I hated it. I was so shy. It was agony for me to talk to those posh ladies each day. I missed my mum dreadfully. Well, Sophie dear, you're probably wondering if I'm ever going to mention the crepe de chine. Do you want some more scrambled eggs? No? Yes, of course you do. Help yourself, there's plenty. I'd been working there for a few weeks when I happened to see a roll of fabric when I walked by the haberdashery department. It was the colour that caught my eye. I've always had an interest in colours. Certain colours make me feel like I've heard music. Mum was the same. She understood. Connie had no idea. Practically colourblind, that girl. Well, this was deep turquoise. And because it was crepe de chine, it had a rich, satiny feel to it, like a jewel. I could imagine Mum saying to me, "Oh, Rose, it's so pretty." For some reason, I became quite fixated with that fabric. I sketched the summer dress I would make with it, just something simple with an A-line skirt and a round neckline. It seemed like if I could make that dress, I could get back my old life. I felt like it would make me closer to Mum. Well, to be honest, I don't know what I thought, really. I think I just went a little mad. I lusted after it. I even dreamed about it, for heaven's sake. And, of course, I didn't have a snowflake's chance in hell of getting it. It was expensive fabric. We didn't have enough money to eat. We certainly didn't have enough money for fabric. Well, I may as well just come out and say this. I stole £2 from the till. I know. I don't look like a thief, do I? But that's what I did. And my mother would have been absolutely horrified. I didn't even think much about it. I didn't even feel guilty. I just wanted that fabric. And of course I was caught by the floor supervisor. I thought of him as an elderly man, but he was probably 40 at the most. He was a short man with a pear-shaped body and an egg-shaped head. I didn't like him at all. I secretly called him Mr. Egghead. I thought Mr. Egghead would sack me, for sure. But instead he took me to the storeroom out the back and said he had a proposal for me. He said he'd be prepared to overlook what I'd done and even let me keep the